this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm filling in for George Douglas today. For the next half hour, for the next hour, actually, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And today we're reading from the issue dated February 8, 2013. And first, the main stories. A bipartisan plan for immigration reform. What happened? A bipartisan group of senators unveiled a proposal for comprehensive immigration reform this week, setting out a roadmap for 11 million illegal immigrants to begin a long journey to full citizenship. The plan by the 8 senators, who included Republicans John McCain and Marco Rubio, and Democrats Chuck Schumer and Robert Menendez, would give undocumented immigrants provisional legal status if they registered with the government, paid a fine, settled their back taxes, and proved they could speak English. They could then join the line for permanent residence or a green card, and thereafter apply for full citizenship. In a provision insisted on by Republicans, permanent resident status would be available only after the government deployed more broader agents. Border agents in unmanned drones for a special commission deemed the southern U.S. border fully secured. President Obama suspended plans to unveil his own immigration proposal and hailed the bipartisan Senate initiative, but he emphasized that lawmakers must act quickly to fix a badly broken system, or he would send his own legislation to Congress. A call for action can now be heard coming from all across America, said Obama. Now's the time. Strong Republican opposition to giving illegal immigrants any legal standing has softened since the presidential election, which Republican Mitt Romney lost, partly because he got only 27% of the Hispanic vote. The Republican Party is losing the support of our Hispanic citizens, said McCain. We have to understand that. What the editorial said. Thanks to an emerging bipartisan consensus, immigration reform may finally be possible, said the Washington Post. But requiring illegal immigrants to go to the back of a waiting line for visas means that most wouldn't get one for a decade or longer, with citizenship even more distant. As paths to citizenship go, that's too long. And a process that requires people to register with the government but wait years for legal status would discourage people from participating. Demanding an airtight border is also unrealistic and unnecessary, said the Los Angeles Times. Illegal crossings are already down 80% since 2000. Border crossing has dropped only because of the lousy state of the U.S. economy, said the Wall Street Journal. And it'll go up once our job creation does. Republicans have to insist on greater border enforcement in the bill to get the conservative rank and file on board. And there's nothing wrong with requiring illegal immigrants to wait years for their papers, said USA Today. Letting them quickly qualify for citizenship would be a slap in the face to those who played by the rules. What the columnist said. Don't let the support of a few Republican senators fool you, said Alex Perrine in Salon.com. In rural white America, right-wing nativism remains a powerful force, and the conservative media is already shouting amnesty. There's no reason to think House Republicans from severely conservative districts will risk infuriating their constituents by voting for any reform package. Nor should they, said Michael Graham in the Boston Herald. Giving amnesty to people who came here illegally to steal American jobs will only produce more illegal immigration tomorrow. It's true that reform will be hard to sell to the right, said Robert Costa in NationalReview.com. But Marco Rubio is a pro at soothing conservatives' anxiety. The Cuban-American senator even convinced Rush Limbaugh to tentatively support the Senate proposal this week. His talent for speaking conservatives' language and his status as a future presidential contender may be the factor ensuring passage of the bill. Conservatives must ask themselves if they want to cling to phony bumper sticker slogans like "No Amnesty," said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com, or face the reality that responsible immigration reform is critical to attracting Latina voters to the party and winning elections. If Obama wants reform, he should stop talking about it, said Ezra Klein, also in WashingtonPost.com. Most Washington Republicans understand the strategic and substantive reasons for making a deal, but conservative voters hate anything overly associated with the Obama administration. The president has made his speech. Now it's up to Congress. By staying out of the deal-making, Obama will make it easier for Republicans to stay in. And that takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Controversy of the Week. The military. Do women belong in combat? The mission of the U.S. military is to defend this nation and its interests, said NationalReview.com in an editorial, not to be an agent of social transformation or a laboratory for feminist innovation. Nevertheless, departing Defense Secretary Leon Panetta announced last week his decision to eliminate all gender-based barriers to service, including the long-standing ban on female troops serving in combat roles. The problem, of course, is that most of the gender-based barriers to women serving in combat, their relative lack of strength and stamina, and the corrosive effect of sexual or romantic tension on unit cohesion, are functions of biology that can't be just eliminated by a bureaucratic order. Evidently, though, the White House cares more about gender correctness than the effectiveness of our frontline troops, said William Crystal in WeeklyStandard.com. Our national security is being jeopardized for an irresponsible act of liberal social experimentation. You silly boys, the experiment has already happened, said William Salatin in Slate.com, and it worked. More than 20,000 women served in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and though they were not officially in combat roles, female soldiers were tested time and again in firefights and ambushes, fighting no less bravely or effectively than their male counterparts, with 152 losing their lives. By lifting the outdated ban on women in combat roles, Panetta is merely acknowledging the new reality and granting qualified service women access to promotions and higher pay. Even as a female soldier, I used to have my doubts about women serving in combat, said Kyla Williams, also in Slate.com. Then I started going out on foot patrols in Iraq with other troops as an Arabic linguist. My ability to help successfully accomplish the mission was all that mattered to my comrades. Indeed, my ability to talk to Iraqis often gave my unit a vital advantage. That's false logic, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. No one disputes that female soldiers have an important role to play, or even that they can return fire when necessary. But most women lack the upper body strength of the vicious men they may meet in face-to-face combat. And is the nation really prepared for grainy videotapes of our captured 18-year-old daughters being raped and tortured by the enemy? The presence of women in combat units will only make traumatic battle conditions worse, said former Marine Ryan Smith in the Wall Street Journal. During the invasion of Baghdad, I spent days at a time huddled with 25 fellow Marines in an assault vehicle built for 15. We urinated in bottles, defecated inches from each other's faces, and were so caked in filth and dried blood that they lined us up naked and washed us off with pressure washers. Trust me, no soldier wants women witnessing and taking part in all of that. Our soldiers should stop whining, said Ralph Peters in the New York Post. Women already played a major role in the armed services and have every right to serve in combat roles, as long as they can meet the same standards of fitness, strength, and toughness as their male counterparts. That's the key, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. If fitness requirements are lowered to be fairer to female recruits, our national security will suffer. But if standards are enforced even-handedly, letting women have access to combat position only expands the pool of talented individuals who can contribute to the fight. And on that same page, we have this: good week for, bad week for. Well, it was a good week for animal liberation. After some 15,000 crocodiles escaped from a South African breeding farm during heavy rains and flooding. There used to be only a few crocodiles in the Limpopo River, said farm worker Zane Langman. Now there are plenty. It was also a good week for declarations of faith after a group of Florida women drove off an armed robber who burst in on their jewelry party by chanting, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus." The intruder said, homeowner Jackie Hagler, ran out the door as fast as he could go. And it was a good week for the rich and paranoid after New York fashion designer Adam Harvey unveiled a new clothing line, Stealthwear, which renders wares invisible to unmanned drones, infrared cameras. A drone-proof hoodie sells for $473 and a full burqa for $2,365. But it was a bad week for trying to change the local culture. After New York City authorities began removing "Don't Honk" street signs from across the city because they're almost universally ignored. And it seems to be a bad week for man boobs. After 35 male members of Germany's elite guard battalion developed breasts on their left-hand sides. The cause? A drill that involved soldiers slamming rifles into their chests, thereby stimulating hormone production in their mammary glands. And finally, it was a bad week for mass communication. After a Scottish receptionist accidentally forwarded a series of intimate emails between her and a coworker to the entire company, and they went viral on the internet. A company spokesman said the couple, who are engaged, did nothing wrong, but regrettably they have chosen to resign. Brings us to the section of the magazine entitled People. And here we have three articles. One, Macy's R-rated philosophy. The second one, The Woman Who Was Saved by Kidnapping. And the third one, Bacon's Celebrity Ambivalence. But first, Macy's R-rated philosophy. William H. Macy doesn't understand why sex is considered more offensive than violence, said Catherine Shord in The Guardian, UK. The actor finds it absurd that movies filled with gunshots, gore, and murder can be classified as PG, while films featuring sex and nudity are guaranteed quarantine behind R ratings. We're so accepting of violence, ugly, ugly, ugly violence, and we let our children watch it, Macy says. And yet we're allergic to sex. I don't know much, but I know this. Violence is bad and sex is good. Even the bad sex I've had was pretty good. Violence is always bad. There are no exceptions. Yet, he says, violence is accepted or even celebrated, while sex is still often treated as something shameful. They say that young kids, especially boys, are thinking about it every 4 seconds. They think about sex more than they think about food. The consequences of these distorted values, he says, are everywhere. Our normal way of suppressing it does not work. You have priests molesting children. You've got husbands and wives torturing each other because we can't talk about anything to do with sex. And we can't be honest about anything, I mean, with the amount of crap we've all had laid on our shoulders about our sexuality, it's a wonder we can function at all. And then there's this, the woman who was saved by kidnapping. Katie Beers doesn't regret that she was once kidnapped by a pedophile, says J. David Goodman in the New York Times. In 1992, Beers was just 9 years old when family friend John Esposito lured her to his house in Bayshore, New York, and then chained her up in an underground concrete bunker he built specifically for her. Esposito kept her there for the next 16 days and molested her repeatedly. She now thinks that this horrific experience, which drew national attention, changed the trajectory of her life for the better. If the kidnapping hadn't happened, I don't even want to think about where I would be, said Beers, 30. I would have never graduated high school or college. I might not even be here living today. Raised in a chaotic, broken family, Beers spent most of her time in the home of a godmother, Linda Ingeleheria, who, Beers says, treated her like a slave. Ingeleheria's husband molested her from the time she was a toddler. But after her kidnapping, Beers was placed with a loving foster family in East Hampton, and they raised her as their own. She went to college, met her husband there, and now has 2 children and a career in insurance. Being abducted, she says, was unfortunately the best thing that happened to me. And finally, in the people section, we have this Bacon celebrity ambivalence. Kevin Bacon had one simple motive for starting a career in movies, fame, said Jane Mulcairns in the Daily Telegraph, UK. Show me an actor who doesn't want to be famous, he says, and I'll show you a liar. Later, you realize that there's more to it than just the acquisition of fame and money and girls, but that is what drove me initially. Bacon quickly got the celebrity he craved. The 1982 cult classic Diner put him on the map, and the 1984 hit Footloose made him an international star. To this day, Bacon, 54, finds it almost impossible to enter a bar or party without the DJ playing the theme song to Footloose, or to walk down the street without fans accosting him to recite lines from Diner. He grew so weary of it that he asked a Hollywood makeup artist a couple of years ago to build him a prosthetic disguise, which he tested out at an L.A. mall. I just wanted to see what it would be like not being famous, he says, rather sheepishly. People didn't bother me, but they also ignored me. No one was nice to me. They looked right through me and pushed in front of me at the register. He hasn't worn it since. And that takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Briefing. Working, but still poor. Why is it that millions of Americans who have jobs can't make ends meet? Who are the working poor? There are the millions of people who have jobs that leave them mired at the edge of poverty. Their ranks include legions of retail clerks at chains like Walmart, fast food workers, dishwashers, customer assistance representatives, home health care aides, factory workers, and farm laborers. Some 46.2 million Americans now live in families where someone is working but earning less than the poverty line, $11,702 a year for an individual, or $23,021 for a family of four. Many economists have a broader definition, saying that the working poor are those whose incomes do not cover basic needs, food, clothing, housing, transportation, child care, and health care. By that standard, there are more than 146 million Americans in the poor but working class. People in this category generally have no savings and survive from check to check, often filling in the gaps by going into debt. Any little thing, a child getting sick, a car breaking down, those are quite significant events for these working families, said Brandon Roberts of the Working Poor Families Project. Where do they live and work? About half the working poor are white, mostly living in the South or Southwest, but African Americans and Latinos are vastly overrepresented in their ranks. Over a quarter of blacks and Latinos live in poverty, while only a tenth of whites do. Most commonly, they work for major national chains whose business models depend on very low labor costs. Walmart, Pizza Hut, McDonald's, Target. In these hugely successful companies, most of the profits goes to top management and stockholders. The top 50 employers of low-wage workers, a recent study found, paid their top executives an average of $9.4 million a year and have returned $175 billion in dividends to their shareholders since 2006. In contrast, the typical worker eligible for the Earned Income Tax Credit, a tax break for low-income workers, has an adjusted gross income of $13,900. Since the Great Recession of 2008, about 60% of the jobs created in the U.S. have been low-wage ones. One out of four Americans now earns less than $10 an hour. Is the minimum wage too low? There is a strong case for that it has been. The federal minimum wage has been frozen at $7.25 since 2009, and the cost of living has risen more than 7% since then. Some economists argue that paying workers more would mean fewer jobs as labor costs rose. But others say that basic economic principle doesn't hold at the low end of the job spectrum. Many of these service jobs can't be outsourced or automated. But thanks to globalization and the waning power of labor unions, workers have little leverage to press for higher salaries. Why are unions shrinking? One major factor is that the manufacturing companies that were once a union stronghold have closed or sent their jobs overseas. But that's not the whole story. Canada's economy has seen similar changes over the past four decades, yet union membership there is still 30%, whereas in the U.S. it is 11.3% overall and less than 7% in the private sector. In the U.S., unions have dwindled partly because poor leadership has damaged their image and partly because of right-to-work laws now in place in 24 states, which effectively bar unions from organizing workers. Do the working poor pay taxes? They pay federal payroll taxes and sales taxes at the same rate as more affluent Americans, but they do not pay federal income taxes. Under tax programs that both Republicans and Democrats supported as a way to get poor people off of welfare, workers with low incomes qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit and often the Child Tax Credit. Perversely, however, these special tax breaks serve as disincentives for the working poor to make more money. A single mother earning $18,000 a year loses tax credits and benefits as she climbs the income scale, so for each additional dollar she makes, She effectively keeps only 12 cents. She has little incentive to increase her hours and her income unless she can make a major jump in salary. Why not simply get a better job? The best way out of low-paying jobs is to get a good higher education. But most of the working poor come from struggling communities where schools are not well-financed, and the kids who attend bad elementary and high schools are far less likely to attend college. Even today, only 30% of Americans get college degrees, and for those with only a high school diploma, job prospects are more limited than ever. The average high school graduate today makes $12,000 less than the average high school graduate did in 1980. Men who are unemployed or in low-wage jobs tend not to marry, or if they do, are likely to get divorced, creating a vicious cycle. Their children often grow up in single-parent homes, which are far more likely to stay poor. Folks in our state are working hard, but for many families, working hard just isn't enough, said F. Scott McCown of the Center for Public Policy Priorities in Austin. Things need to change. How taxpayers subsidize Walmart. Walmart is the largest private employer in the U.S. and has the most workers on public assistance. In 2007, the company shifted from regular shifts to flexible shifts, a change labor activists said was designed to force full-time workers to downgrade their status to part-time so they would not qualify for health insurance or other benefits. The result is that hundreds of thousands of Walmart employees rely on state benefits or Medicaid. Most of the company's warehouses are contracted out to temp agencies, so even if a warehouse loader works full-time in a Walmart warehouse for years, he gets no benefits. Walmart has also spent at least $1 billion since 2005 settling lawsuits over unpaid wages or illegal working conditions. One study estimated that Walmart workers cost taxpayers more than $1 billion every year. And that takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Best Columns, the U.S. And here we have three articles. One, He's Not the Liberal Reagan Yet, by Ross Duhat from the NewYorkTimes.com. The second article is What War Does to Soldiers, by Timothy Kudo in the Washington Post. And the final article is Sarah Palin Exits Stage Right, Paul Waldman, The American Prospect. But first, he's not the liberal Reagan yet. Will President Obama realize his goal of becoming the liberal Ronald Reagan? Asked Ross Duhat. Obama is well on his way to achieving a philosophical reorientation of American domestic politics, promoting what he calls collective action, that is, an activist government to solve the country's problems. It's a clear attempt to undo Reagan's conservative revolution in which government was seen not as the solution, but as the problem. But while Obama has, in two successful elections, built a genuine liberal majority, philosophical victories have to last to be considered real. He has yet to prove that his government-driven solutions will work. In a still sluggish economy, nearly 13 million Americans remain unemployed. Obamacare could yet fall apart at the seams due to its design flaws and incredible complexity. Budget deficits remain sky high. At the start of Reagan's second term, 51% of Americans were very satisfied with the nation's direction. Today, only 23% are. Unless Obama's results match his rhetoric, the nation's shift to the left will remain at least partly reversible, and his legacy will fall short of his grand dreams. What War Does to Soldiers. While I was on patrol in Afghanistan in 2010, said Marine Captain Timothy Kudo, my squad saw a motorcycle racing towards us. The two riders did not respond to our shouts to stop, and we began firing and killed them. The riders turned out to be unarmed civilians, and one looked no older than 16. Every day I think about those people and others whose deaths I ordered. The images floor into my mind while I'm showering, walking down the street, or watching a movie. I am haunted by the feeling that I am no longer the good person I once thought I was. The Veterans Administration, now coping with an epidemic of veteran suicide, has a euphemism for this feeling: moral injury. Even if soldiers are told killing is necessary in war, taking the lives of other human beings violates a deep prohibition that cannot be rationalized away. When I tell civilians I'm an Afghan vet, they often ask, "Did you kill anyone?" It's an incredibly insensitive question, but here's your answer. Yes, I did, and I'll never fully get over it. And finally, this piece entitled Sarah Palin Exits Stage Right. Sarah Palin is finally going away, said Paul Waldman. Her star has fallen so far that even Fox News no longer wants her as a commentator. Since she was plucked from Alaskan obscurity to be John McCain's running mate in 2008, Palin has been a unique political figure, fascinating to both liberals and conservatives. She combined white-hot charisma with implacable self-confidence, despite displaying a level of understanding of public affairs that would embarrass an average seventh grader. Liberals loved to hate her, delighting every time she said something even more idiotic and offensive than she had before. Whether it was creating new words, refudiate, or explaining that she was quitting as governor because finishing her term would be the quitter's way out, social conservatives adored her because she tapped so effectively into their resentment, the acid bile of the culture war. Palin spoke for all those who felt looked down on by Northeastern elites, big city sophisticates, and the media. But her 15 minutes is over, and now St. Joan of the Tundra will fade from public view. In a few years, we'll wonder what it was all about. That takes us to talking points, the first article of which is Clinton has Benghazi damaged her 2016 chances. One word sums up Hillary Clinton's performance before Congress last week: presidential, said David Rothkopf in CNN.com. Appearing before a Senate committee looking into the deadly September 11th attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, the departing Secretary of State commanded the stage and deftly repulsed effort after effort by Republican partisans to use her as a punching bag. She tore into Senator Ron Johnson, who tried to push the conspiracy theory that the Obama administration wanted the public to view the deadly raid as a protest gone wrong, rather than a planned act of terrorism. What difference at this point does it make? Clinton shouted, pounding the table with her fist. We had four dead Americans. She accepted responsibility for the compound's poor security and said she has spent her final months at state making sure Benghazi doesn't happen again. If Clinton does decide to enter the 2016 race, her courage in facing down her Republican inquisitors will only boost her chances, says Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune. She stands tall when her critics look so small. Quit fawning, said Jonah Goldberg at NationalReview.com. If you listen to what she said, it's clear that Clinton lied and is still lying. She denied, for example, ever claiming herself that the raid was sparked by a protest over a U.S.-made anti-Islam video. Yet when Clinton received the caskets of the Americans killed in Benghazi, she blamed their deaths on that awful internet video that we had nothing to do with. Like other members of the Obama administration, Clinton used the video to dodge responsibility for the failure to provide adequate security for our diplomats, a dodge she continued last week. Clinton's performance was worthy of an Oscar, said Jeffrey Kuhner in the Washington Times. She choked back the tears when describing seeing the bodies of Ambassador Chris Stevens and his staff, then coldly blamed her subordinates for turning down Stevens' multiple requests for more security. Her practiced lying brought to mind her steely-eyed dissembling during the many scandals of her husband's administration, from Travelgate to the allegations that he sexually assaulted Paula Jones and two other women. What a load of sexist nonsense, said Janae Overstet in the Kansas City Star. If a man had sobbed while describing a staff member's funeral, he'd have been applauded for such a rare show of tender emotion. Clinton, meanwhile, is dubbed a faker and a manipulator. Conservatives also described her as frightening, witchy, and seething with rage. Women with their own thoughts and ways are scary to some men in politics. What's frightening is that this lousy diplomat could one day be president, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. During a fawning 60 Minutes joint interview with Clinton last weekend, Obama all but anointed her as his successor, saying she is one of the finest Secretary of States we've had. Huh? Yes, she traveled a lot, but under her watch, America's power has weakened. Rogue states Iran and North Korea are boldly defying the U.S. The U.S. has shown no leadership on Syria and Libya. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is more hopeless than ever, and we're now preparing to abandon Afghanistan as we did in Iraq. Today, however, politics is based on race, gender, and other identity markers that are immune to traditional standards of accountability. The women who make up a large part of the Democratic base have liked the idea of a female president, and that's all that counts. It's not just the women who admire Clinton, said Richard Cross, the third, in the Baltimore Sun. Almost 70% of all voters view her favorably, as do 65% of independents and 37% of Republicans. Her time as Secretary of State has softened her partisan image. The Clinton of the 90s, veteran of the health care debacle, Whitewater, scandal figure, and critic of the vast right-wing conspiracy has been largely left behind. Clearly, the Democratic nomination is hers if she wants it, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com. But should Clinton run for president, Republican attacks on her character, looks, and performance will soon become the norm, just as it was from 1992 to 2008. Last week was just a small reminder of the price she'll have to pay if she wants to return to the White House. Maybe it was enough to make her wonder, do I really want to do this all over again? And the second article under Talking Points is Social Spending, Paying for the Takers. In his second inaugural address last week, said Nicholas Eberstadt in the Wall Street Journal, President Obama insisted that programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security do not make us a nation of takers. The facts, unfortunately, say otherwise. Indeed, our increasing dependency on state largesse now threatens America's future. Social welfare and entitlement programs now consume two-thirds of the federal budget, double their share in 1960. 49% of U.S. households now receive checks or benefits from one social welfare program or another, including entitlement programs and disability. Even Social Security and Medicare do not pay for themselves and function only because the old are handing the debt to their children. Yes, Mr. President, we are a nation of takers, and this new something-for-nothing mentality is eroding the American worth ethic. Obama's critics imply that he rejected any cuts in safety net programs, said Jonathan Chait in NewYorkMagazine.com. This is untrue. He has openly stated his willingness to make changes so these programs remain viable, and in past negotiations with congressional Republicans has offered significant cuts. In repudiating the Republicans' rhetoric about takers, Obama was drawing an important moral distinction. He pointed out that misfortune can strike Americans in all forms, a disability, a storm, illness, or merely outliving our savings, and we have some obligation to each other. Contrast that with the approach of Republican hero, Representative Paul Ryan, whose budget imposes savage cuts to food stamps, children's health insurance, and other programs for the neediest while rejecting any tax increases on the wealthiest. Ryan even voted against relief for victims of Hurricane Sandy. Do Republicans really want to base their party on this kind of heartlessness? You can defend the morality of taking all you like, said Major Garrett in NationalJournal.com, but somehow we must pay for it. Social Security and Medicare outlays are soaring by 25% a year, and the Social Security Disability Program is racing toward insolvency by 2016. The makers can't keep up with what the takers are taking. In his stirring defense of social spending, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com, Obama left out the less palatable side of the citizenship bargain, the obligation to pay for the social safety net. Unless he confronts that obligation, he'll be passing off a time bomb to the next president. And that takes us to the last word. Why more guns won't make us safer. People may think firearms will protect them, says Sean Faircloth, but statistics show otherwise. In his article on gun control in the last issue of the week, author Sam Harris argued that firearms serve as a great equalizer, enabling good men and women to defend themselves against stronger and more aggressive attackers. I respect Sam, but he failed to address the two most important pieces of evidence related to this issue: how frequently guns are used in domestic violence against women, and the data confirming the success of gun control in other countries. It will come as no surprise to most people that men commit homicide 10 times as often as women. Their victims are often women. 2/3 of women killed by spouses are killed with guns. Firearm assaults on female family members and intimate acquaintances are approximately 12 times more likely to result in death than are assaults using other weapons. This is not some minor secondary issue, it is the heart of the matter, a form of chronic and pervasive domestic terrorism. It is impossible to claim to address gun violence in America while failing to address domestic violence against women. The vast majority of gun owners are not maniacs. The vast majority are not planning on shooting their girlfriends, wives, or partners. But in a fit of anger or jealousy or some other overwhelming emotion, a gun can become a convenient way of lashing out. The decision to shoot can take a second and then can't be undone. It happens every day in this country. These are the sad facts of life. The many thousands of people who bought guns after the Connecticut massacre deem themselves to be just as responsible as gun enthusiast Harris. Most are. But take a step back. As the Harvard School of Public Health found, guns in the home are used more often to frighten intimates than to thwart crime. This is why Harris's gun protects women argument doesn't withstand practical scrutiny. In a sane world, getting a gun would be treated more rigorously than buying a car, and government-mandated safety training and psychological screening would be required before purchase. Yet most gun advocates would object to even these steps, and these safeguards would do nothing to protect women, particularly low-income women, who live in an ocean of guns but simply choose not or cannot afford to buy guns and get properly trained. Should we require women to own guns to protect themselves from gun-owning partners? Second, Harris fails to delve into the data comparing U.S. gun violence with that of other developed nations. America's rate of homicide with guns is dramatically higher than that of most countries that have strict gun control policies. There are gangs in Europe. They kill each other less frequently because they have less access to guns. Sadly, men engage in domestic violence in other developed countries, but they have less access to guns than do American men. The neglect of the data regarding these critically important topics means that the most important two aspects of gun violence in America are not really analyzed in Harris's piece. He instead offers that it is reasonable that he judges himself to be psychologically stable and committed to safe handling of firearms. I worked briefly as a prosecutor before serving an elective office. Harris's argument or statement about himself is ironic, given the stark realities law enforcement faces when dealing with vast numbers of people. Does Sam or Joe or Jim think he's stable when he buys a gun? Of course. We all think that. But in the real world, it's later that the gun gets drawn. Men, often drunk, get in fights. Men, often drunk, become jealous or want to control women. As anger or jealousy boils, stability and commitment to safe handling can change, and do change, often, and often very quickly, into a dangerous and often lethal rage. Harris devotes space to discussing his positive experience at target practice. This fails to capture the drunken rages that, in America, distinctly, are supercharged by guns. And, though more rare, let's consider, do maniacs who engage in mass shootings deem themselves stable? It's a silly question, of course. They can get guns in this country just as easily as intellectual authors or an otherwise normal man who, sparked by circumstance or predisposition or both, flies into a blind rage. Harris drags out the swimming pool canard. You've heard this. Children are more likely to die in pools than by getting shot. Therefore, children dying by gun violence should be dismissed as just one of those things. Similar reasoning works like this. Women are about 8 times more likely to die from cardiovascular disease than by breast cancer. So all that concern about breast cancer is overblown. Please. It is entirely reasonable that society can and should work to address breast cancer and cardiovascular disease, hospital hygiene safety, Harris raises this chestnut too, and handguns. The either-or choice is a rhetorical trick, not a reasoned argument. In fact, we can and must in public policy balance issues, not by comparing swimming pools to handguns, but by considering the pluses and minuses unique to each. What are the advantages and disadvantages of pools? How many Michael Phelps are produced? Very few. How many people live healthier, more pleasurable lives? Millions upon millions. How many save themselves from drowning because they learn to swim in a pool? Many, myself included. Swimming pools, you will concede, have popular attributes, very positive. Indeed, healthful attributes that benefit millions. What positive is offered by guns? The pleasure of target practice? Perhaps. But the risk of death and the widespread terrorizing of women, I would submit, far outweigh the pleasure of shooting at a paper body on a target. As the data make clear, the mythological self-defense argument is outweighed by domestic violence, accidents, and suicides that exist in much smaller percentages in other developed nations. Harris offers that some people will kill people with hunting rifles, which are more accurate than handguns, but that's a side issue. Most people aren't Oswald-style killers. Far more common are the angry situations with handguns that Harris does so little to confront. The handgun is easily the most convenient and most common choice for the loaded man wanting a loaded gun. The combination that causes so much terror in America every single day, it is the crux of the issue. Regardless of our position on the issue, we must squarely acknowledge that America would dramatically reduce killing in general and fatal domestic violence in particular if we dramatically reduced access to handguns. Harris dismisses a reduction of access to handguns and automatic and semi-automatic weapons with the gun flood argument. This argument allows one to shrug one's shoulders and conclude, well, America's flooded with guns, especially handguns, so we'll just have to tell everyone to, well, buy more guns. Will the NRA's still tell everyone to buy more guns argument make women safer? Harris does not answer this question because the answer is most certainly no. The proposed new gun flood will, in the real world, mean more women killed in domestic violence. This is indeed the best NRA argument, however cynical. They say implicitly, one, we flooded America with guns quite successfully, so now it's too late, and therefore explicitly, number two, be afraid and buy more guns. Toward the end of his piece, Harris slips in that he favors strict gun licensing and background checks, I commend him, but on two critical remedies he backs up his NRA rhetoric with NRA policy positions. Both are wrong. Those two are handgun buybacks and legislation removing the handgun from its prevalent place in the American way of life, a prevalence that does not exist in so many other entirely productive, more safe, and more healthy developed countries. I'm glad that Harris and I agree that a well-regulated militia does not include every Tom, Dick, and drunk or angry Harry. However, he quickly offers a second argument against handgun buybacks and restrictions. He says it is not politically feasible in 2012. Assuming that conclusion is true, it is irrelevant. In 1955, it would have been reasonable to conclude that a civil rights bill was not going to pass. Opponents falsely claimed that a civil rights law was unconstitutional. I suppose civil rights organizers and sympathetic politicians could have dusted their hands and had cocktails instead. That a sound policy may not become law today says nothing about whether a movement can be built to address a horrible injustice, an injustice that falls especially harshly on women and the poor. An injustice that would only be made far worse by flooding the country with even more guns, particularly more handguns. Let me make two predictions, one melancholy, one optimistic. First, given the makeup of the current Congress, transformational action in the next 2 years is unlikely, and there will be more massacres and even more horrific and increasing deaths in America, day in and day out, often victims of domestic violence and mostly with the use of handguns. And second, a movement can and will arise that will capitalize on changing demographics and eventually reverse this gun flood policy, thus allowing people and rationality to survive and prevail. But there will be many unnecessary, horrible deaths before America finally does the right thing. I was told less than 10 years ago that a black president was a political impossibility in my lifetime. Many had heard similar statements from smart people. This nation is changing demographically every day. We cannot predict all the trends, but the path of continuing gun violence is the path of death, carnage, and policy disaster. the path of removing non-hunting guns, including handguns, combined with strong regulation is a path of practical promise and a path of life, a path worth the investment of serious organized effort. It is entirely possible that we can work successfully for legislation that removes handguns and assault weapons, which have no sporting use, and can create a strong buyback program to counteract the NRA-orchestrated gun flood. Given the carnage guaranteed by the alternative, we have no ethical choice but to organize. We have no ethical choice but to give this cause our best. Enraged men with loaded guns are the most dangerous and pervasive part of this problem. Very frequently, those killed will be terrorized family members who deserve much more respect than the NRA has offered them so far. And that takes us to this article entitled Electoral College, How to Steal an Election. If you can't win by playing fair, cheat, said Charles M. Blow in the New York Times. Apparently, that's the new Republican strategy for winning presidential elections. Last week, Virginia's state Senate snuck through a bill to replace the state's winner-take-all electoral vote system with a one rewarding electors by congressional district. The change would give greater voting power to rural areas which favor the GOP and less to populous urban areas which support Democrats. Under this system, Mitt Romney would have gotten 9 of Virginia's 13 electoral votes despite losing the state to Obama by 150,000 votes. This is nonetheless a bad idea, said James Taranto in WSJ.com. If GOP-controlled states change electoral college rules for partisan ends, Democrats will do the same when they are in control. Soon, rules will differ from state to state and the whole system will start looking rigged. Here's an alternative idea for Republicans, said David Weigel in Slate.com. Treat urban votes just like they're worth winning. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder have won elections in blue states by treating cities and suburban moderates with respect. Try it. It's more honorable than cheating. And finally, Poll Watch. 66% of Americans support allowing women in the military to serve in direct combat, while 26% are opposed. That's from the Pew Research Center, The Washington Post. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Services wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long. Until next time.